Let's do a little math. First, you have 6 million children. Now add lots and lots and lots of amphetamines to their daily diets. Little blue and orange pills it's pretty hard to keep track of. What do you get? Reality, for one thing, and an ADHD nation. That's the premise and the title of a new book by our guest, who says that 1 in 7 American kids are being diagnosed with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. And that simply doesn't add up. Except to profits, maybe, for pharmaceutical companies. We're joined now for a fuller story by Alan Schwartz, a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize and an investigative journalist for the New York Times. Schwartz penned more than 100 articles about the seriousness of concussions in the NFL, reporting that led to national safety reforms for young athletes. His latest book is true to form, exhaustively researched yet highly readable. ADHD Nation came out in hardback this month, and it's based on more than 1,000 interviews with doctors, parents, children, pharmaceutical executives, teachers, and researchers. The journalist behind it all joins us now with insights from ADHD Nation. Alan Schwartz, welcome to The Exchange.
Hi.
Looks like we got to you a little late there, but we're glad to have you anyway. Welcome to the program.
Oh, well, it's great. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. So you're not suggesting that ADHD isn't real, but you are presenting some pretty staggering evidence about kids without real ADHD getting labeled as such.
Well, exactly. We can accept the construct as we've designed it in psychiatry. Now, I'm not a doctor, but you know, the American Psychiatric Association, which has written the official definition of ADHD, says that about 5% of children have this disorder. Whatever it may be and however we should diagnose it, it's about 5. Well, guess what? We're diagnosing 15%. As you said, 1 in 7.
Wow.
And that's millions of extra children beyond those who really do fit the definition, or at least are close enough. Millions of children being told there's something wrong with your brain function. And while some kids accept that and it doesn't really affect them too much, there are a lot of kids who, you know, we really shouldn't be telling that there's something wrong with you when there isn't. Now, they may have some other problems. They may have anxiety. They may have some dyslexia. There may be trauma in the home that results in inattention and poor type behavior at school. They could have a sleep disorder. They could have a bad diet. There are all sorts of things that can manifest themselves in ADHD behaviors other than ADHD itself. And we need to do a much more judicious job in identifying the kids who really do fit the construct.
Well, let's take a minute here to talk about what the construct is and why so many people might be getting mislabeled as ADHD. What are the classic symptoms?
Well, the classic symptoms basically divide themselves into three groups: hyperactivity, impulsivity, and inattention. Now, hyperactivity does not always need to be present. Oftentimes it is in boys. But you know, more often in girls, it manifests itself as inattention. And then in those three groups, inattention, here are some of the symptoms. Often has trouble holding attention on tasks or play activities. Does not seem to listen when spoken to directly. Okay, hyperactivity, impulsivity, often fidgets with or taps hands or feet or squirms in seat, often leaves seat in situations when remaining seated is expected. Now, of course, these symptoms sound like every child from time to time, okay?
Right.
And so that presents some difficulties. Now, you know, the definition used to be that these symptoms had to be severe, had to impair the child. Well, they've been loosening it for so long that now it says that these are symptoms that merely interfere with functioning.
Who's
and
functioning?
That's a very wide spigot.
Mm-hmm.
And it is allowing many kids to, you know, fit the definition from time to time when they wouldn't have been diagnosed many years ago.
And in this diagnostic process, I think one of the most surprising things for me in reading your book, ADHD Nation, was learning about that and the fact that there's no test or brain scan or something you might call empirical. Could you talk to us a little bit more about what is used to diagnose kids with ADHD?
Well, as you said, there's really no blood test or brain scan, and that doesn't make it any less real or certainly any less different or any more different from depression or anxiety or schizophrenia or things like that. I mean, what we do in this area in psychiatry is simply try to do our best in assessing the behaviors and symptoms of the person involved. And, you know, that can be done very carefully and very judiciously over a long period of time. I mean, it really takes 3 or 4 or 5 sessions with, for example, a child psychiatrist to really get deep down into why is this child behaving in the way that he is? How is he behaving? And I say he, of course, it could be a she. Why are they behaving that way? What is our best guess? What might else be the problem? Unfortunately, this takes a long time. And you know what? It's expensive. But, you know, so you find doctors and parents just wanting to get it all over with and have it done in 20 minutes. And that's criminal, frankly.
Well, and I'm looking at this 39-question questionnaire that's so often used to diagnose ADHD, the Connors rating scale, and it seems like this would actually take you about half an hour to fill out. It's 39 questions where you're rating a child's behavior. Restless, are they squirmy? Do they daydream? Do they pout and sulk? Things that everyone does, but in this case, they're being rated on a scale of 1 to 3.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is that this questionnaire that you referred to that was developed by a doctor named Keith Connors, who has been active in this field since the early 60s. In fact, he was the fellow who basically discovered Ritalin's effect in, you know, difficult-to-control children. So he's somebody who's been around for a long time. This questionnaire isn't supposed to make the diagnosis. It's only supposed to give information to consider, and I'm sure we'll keep discussing this after the break.
Right, a lot more to talk about with Dr. Keith Connors, the history of the ADHD diagnosis and the drugs that are developed to treat it. Our guest is Alan Schwartz, and hopefully you will have phone number and email address coming up after a short break. I'm Emily Curitan, and this is the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you for getting me out of work.
I'll be blunt. Your son is a ravenous demon, relentlessly gnawing at all that's good and true.
Yeah, he's something else, all right.
But worst of all, he drags down the grades of anyone who sits near him. Just look at this pattern.
Hey, that looks like Bart.
And turning to the 3D map, we see an unmistakable cone of ignorance.
Put it away.
Very well, but there's no escaping the truth. Bart has a classic case of attention deficit disorder.
You mean like John Leguizamo?
How should I know? The point is ADD makes children restless and easily distracted.
Hi, Marge. It's me, Homer. What, time to go?
Please, Mr. Simpson.
All right, just a favorite moment of mine there from The Simpsons. We're talking about ADHD here on the Jefferson Exchange, and their Principal Skinner diagnosing Bart with a classic case. We want to hear from you as well. Have you or your child ever been diagnosed with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, or have you ever been misdiagnosed? That's the real thrust of our topic today with author and investigative journalist Alan Schwartz. You can join us, 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. So, Alan, we just heard that little clip from The Simpsons, and while it makes me laugh, I'm also reminded of some of the real challenges laid out in your book, ADHD Nation, especially when you talk about an educator or someone other than a child psychiatrist filling out Connor's questionnaire, of course, developed by Dr. Keith Connors. Can you talk more about that and who and how we diagnose kids with ADHD?
Well, specifically with respect to those questionnaires, which, again, Dr. Connors started his as merely, you know, a helpful tool, they've evolved into these little 18-question and sometimes even 6-question little things where, hey, just check off this box, and then they add up a numerical score, and boom, if you have over 15, you too might have ADHD. I mean, it's just a blatant misuse of what is supposed to be an information-gathering tool. Now, You need to get that information from teachers. In some ways, teachers are arguably the most accurate evaluators of what is and is not ADHD, largely because they know children and the varying behaviors of children really well, and the parent generally knows their own child. So these are important tools. The problem is that everyone thinks they know what ADHD is. They've seen children who exhibit these behaviors, and they assume that it's ADHD, which is the problem that we've had for so many years. And we've loosened the definition to the point where no one really knows what it is anymore.
Let's talk about someone who we would think would know what it is. That's Dr. Keith Connor, one of the sort of pioneers of the diagnosis, and also one of the first people to do a clinically rigorous test of Ritalin in children. How did he go from being someone who, in his own lab work and work with children, really supported the use of these drugs to someone with some regrets in his old age and his later years?
Well, I think it's possible to have both.
Uh-huh.
He was trying to target those, and I'm this is his number, not mine, those, you know, 2-3% of children, mostly boys, who are absolutely impaired by these behaviors and an inability to control oneself and to pay attention, which, you know, can destroy a child's chance at what we consider a normal education. Now, of course, our definition of an education has changed over the years, and that plays some role in this. But he was really trying to help the kids who had this, or who fit the construct. And he spent 40 years, almost 50 years, helping, you know, doctors learn what it was, and in fact helping pharmaceutical companies develop more targeted treatments for kids. And so he was part of this thing trying to help the 2-3%. And it was only after, frankly, my articles in the New York Times that he realized, oh my goodness, what has gone on here? And he now considers ADHD diagnoses perfectly reasonable if they're done properly. But he considers ADHD misdiagnosis a what he called, quote, a national disaster of dangerous proportions. And those are the misdiagnoses that arguably outnumber the correct diagnoses. And he's simply aghast at what the field has devolved into.
And is this largely because of the treatment and the prescription medications are having such a palpable effect on people's lives? In addition to, it seems to me that there's kind of two elements to this, where someone is labeled as having a permanent brain disorder, and that has its effect. And then being prescribed amphetamines is a completely different ball of wax. I'd love to kind of go back to, say, Baltimore, 1962, with Dr. Connors, this first clinical trial of Ritalin in children, and trace the arc of this drug, which is now such a household name, how it came to be prescribed to so many kids, 15% of which in America are now diagnosed with ADHD.
Well, I think what you've seen is the seduction of a pill, a drug, that can improve a child's behavior and his or her attention span. Now, it can do that in many people, in most human beings. You don't need ADHD to, you know, develop a focus or feel an increased focus, an increased attention span, you know, a stick-to-itiveness for tedious tasks. With these drugs, they may be more, the improvements may be more noticeable in people who have severe deficits in that area. But just because a child improves on these two drugs, which we'll get into in a minute, that doesn't mean they had ADHD in the first place, and that's part of the problem.
But then what's the harm? I mean, if you have a kid who's slipping in school and then they are prescribed Ritalin or Adderall and their grades go up?
Well, I don't know if that's a harm. I mean, that's for a nation to discuss.
Mm-hmm.
If we want to have 15% of our kids told that they have a potentially life-changing, devastating, might be with you the rest of your life brain disorder, it's not for me to say. I just think that we know full well that it's being mishandled all over the place, at least according to the American Psychiatric Association, which has, you know, told us what this thing is and isn't. And so I don't know why they are not up in arms about all this. They're not, for reasons. reasons we can discuss later. But, you know, I think you hit on something very important earlier, which is that there are two problems here. There is the problem of telling a child there's essentially something wrong with you, wrong with your brain, or certainly off with your brain. And then also the medications. Now, the medications are in two different categories. There's the amphetamine, which is Adderall, Adderall XR, Vyvanse, things like that, and methylphenidate, which is Ritalin and generally Concerta, now Concerta. They are virtually identical, okay, but they are two different sort of classes. And, you know, for a kid who's under 12, I think the risk is saying that, gee, you know, he improved on these drugs. He must have had ADHD. Well, that's like saying, gee, you know, we put these platform shoes on him and he got taller. He must have been short. Well, you know, anybody gets taller in platform shoes, dummy. And so they feel as if the diagnosis is confirmed. And next thing you know, the kid, you know, is on Concerta for a year or three or more. And, you know, if his grades, you know, improve, which can happen, maybe that's a good thing. You know, it's not for me to say. What I want to do is inform everybody that this is what we're doing, and we need to decide as a nation if this is what we want for, you know, this and future generations of children.
Could you tell us how and why ADHD became a quote, good news diagnosis to some
people?
Well,
that quote is from a doctor named Ned Hollowell, who really changed the history of the disorder. For a long time, the 70s, when it was known as minimal brain dysfunction, to the 80s, after it had been rebranded attention deficit disorder, it was a very controversial diagnosis, particularly in the late 1980s. And in the early 90s, there was a great resistance on the part of parents and some doctors to make the diagnosis. It was very controversial. Anyway, Ned Hollowell, who is a psychiatrist in Boston, and a pretty prominent one, wrote a book called Driven to Distraction, where he informed everybody that this was a good news diagnosis, that, hey, if you get diagnosed with ADHD, then if your kid, he takes medication, probably, not always, and he can thrive. He can become, you know, a genius. He can soar. And that was very seductive to people. The book sold more than 1 million copies. It was a huge bestseller because it told parents, hey, it's okay. You know, it's okay. Don't worry about the diagnosis because your kid will improve on it. And, of course, sometimes that's right. And that is a nice service for parents to not resist this thing that may help your child. The problem is it encouraged a gazillion people whose kids did not have ADHD to decide that they did and give them medication that was really not appropriate in that circumstance. It was very seductive. Every parent wants their kid to do better in school. Every parent wants their kid to be less disruptive and more calm. Also in the home. I mean, the pharmaceutical companies, which I'm sure we're about to get to, literally targeted that feeling. They had ads that had a parent holding their child with a B-plus paper. The title, the headline said, finally, grades that match his intelligence. What parent thinks that their kid's grades match their intelligence? And so what it was doing is saying, hey, if you take Adderall, his grades will, or if he takes Adderall, his grades will improve, which was really not scientifically based by any means. And it just distorted what these meds are really for.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Alan Schwartz. He is an investigative journalist. His new book is ADHD Nation. It explores children doctors, big pharma, and the making of an American epidemic, talking about the misdiagnoses of attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. You'd expect 5% of American children to have it. More like 15% are being diagnosed. We welcome you to join this conversation at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. Now, Alan, we've been talking a lot about how the verbs for describing this disorder came around and these medications, how did pharmaceutical companies become intertwined with the science of diagnosis and with the research around kind of a nebulous idea here, not something we can test for, as we've already established?
Well, pharmaceutical companies have long been in the business of creating, you know, medications or drugs or whatever you want to call it, which make people feel better. They've done a fantastic job at doing that. I think it's hard to argue otherwise. And we all take products of pharmaceutical companies, whether it be, you know, Tylenol or cancer drugs or goodness knows what. And they've made society better in a lot of ways. However, sometimes their pursuit of profits goes way beyond what the products do and what the products can promise. And they can encourage people to think they have a problem when, in fact, they really don't. And we've seen a gazillion different examples of this. And it's primarily, or maybe not primarily, but a lot of it has taken place in psychiatry, because there is no definite way to diagnose and confirm that the person really is supposed to consider this drug. Anybody can feel depressed. Anybody can feel anxious. Anybody can feel ADHD or think their child has ADHD. And the pharmaceutical companies have, in many ways, co-opted the academic and medical establishment by saying, we'll pay you all this money to study this stuff so that whenever you find something, we can say that it wasn't us who discovered it, it was you guys. And the doctors and academics who are given five, six, sometimes even seven figures over a number of years, of course they're going to try to find things that make the pharmaceutical companies happy. And one of the things I do in the book is really trace how the ADHD field got completely hijacked by the pharmaceutical companies to the point where they took something that really could have been helpful to a relatively small number of kids and made it into a serious drug problem.
I want to take a second to kind of drop us into that field at a point in time that seems like something of a turning point, or at least in the midst of this wave of misdiagnoses and a lot of prescription drugs going out to kids. We're in Maryland here in 1998. The National Institute of Health convenes, and in the parlance of my grandmother, this seems like something of a come-to-Jesus meeting for everyone involved in the ADHD field. You've got parents, doctors, researchers, pharmaceutical companies, and the public and the media all getting together for this divisive debate. And there, a reporter asks a panel of pediatric experts what to me seems like a pretty straightforward question. I asked you right off the bat in this interview to describe a typical child with ADHD or describe the symptoms. It's really notable that as this is happening, no one really steps up wanting to take this question. And then Dr. Mark Vonnegut is appointed to answer. And it's pretty, you describe it, spectacular what happens next. Let's hear it.
These kids stick out like sore thumbs, and they are difficult. They aggravate their parents. But then it's further confounded by the fact there are subtypes of attention deficit disorder where kids have the problems with inattention without the hyperactivity. I think, you know, I don't think the panel is saying anything different, although we said it in more sophisticated ways, is the diagnosis is a mess.
So the diagnosis is a mess. Quite a soundbite there. How do we have a diagnosis that's a mess, resulting in 15% of kids in the country having this diagnosis and many of them being prescribed prescription medication for it?
Well, it was a great soundbite, and it did appear on, you know, on programs and newspapers and news accounts nationwide. The problem is that it was really drowned out by an ADHD establishment that said, oh my God, I can't believe what Vonnegut just said. We need to counter it with all sorts of other sound bites. And they won the day. Those folks won the day to the point where Time magazine devoted its cover to the next issue to the meeting. And the cover had a picture of a little boy whose head came into focus. His fuzzy head sort of comes into focus. And it said, the latest on Ritalin. Doctors said last week that it works. That was the report. And it's true. Doctors said last week that it works because, you know what? Ritalin and Adderall and Concerta, they do work. They do make kids calm down and pay attention. But that doesn't mean that they have a brain disorder. And it was from that moment on, although there were a lot of significant issues that immediately followed it, not the least of which being that all of a sudden ADHD meds, which had been given the green light by the National Institutes of Health, they started being advertised to the general public, which had been forbidden, but technically was not against United States law. And so the FDA and Congress were completely powerless, basically, to say, wait a minute, hold on a second, you can't, you know, advertise controlled substances, very addictive substances, to the general public. Well, there was no law against it, and all hell broke loose.
And we haven't talked about the addictive properties of these drugs yet, so it sounds like people would go to their doctors or be subject to these marketing campaigns and almost self-diagnose or want to insist on these magic pills.
Well, yeah, that can happen, and I look forward to talking about that very soon.
All right. Well, Alan Schwartz here. I'm Emily Curitan. Alan's our guest, and we'll be talking a lot more about ADHD Nation, his new book based on a lot of reporting for the New York Times. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange, final segment today. I'm Emily Curitan, in for Jeffrey Riley. Our guest is Alan Schwartz, investigative journalist, nominated for a Pulitzer Prize for his reporting on concussions in the NFL. He joins the debate now with his new book, ADHD Nation, Children, Doctors, Big Pharma, and the Making of an American Epidemic. We want to hear from you on this one. What's your experience with an ADHD diagnosis and with the drugs that are often prescribed for it? Adderall, Ritalin, Concerta, there's others. Please give us a call, 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org to email. I want to go to a call now. Sally in Medford, welcome to the Exchange.
Thank you. Good program, well moderated. I wanted to ask Mr. Schwartz to describe the difference between amphetamines that are in the drugs prescribed to kids and methamphetamines that we see all over our streets, and also ask if he has information regarding the long-term, any brain changes or effects from kids being on these kind of drugs for a period of time.
Great question, Sally. Thank you.
Yeah, let me take the second part first. The long-term effects of these drugs are not particularly well understood. Okay, there are just so many studies that can be done because there are so many confounding factors with the kids who, you know, are and frankly are not, which is your control group, put on the medications. I think that it's, and I'm not a doctor, I am not one of the conventional academic researchers. But I don't think there has been any good work done saying yay or nay in terms of, you know, these drugs help or hurt the brain long term.
But they are addictive. We know that.
Oh, well, they're addictive to different degrees in different age groups. Okay. And I think we need to make sure that parents don't feel as if, you know, their 9-year-old kid is going to get addicted to Concerta. You know, if you monitor the meds appropriately and educate and make sure they don't take too much or trade in school or anything like that, which happens in high schools usually, you know, you can mitigate some of those addictive qualities, particularly in young children. So I don't want to give parents the wrong idea with respect to that. It's incredibly addictive when you misuse it as an adolescent and a young adult, or adult for that matter. But in terms of the long-term brain changes, I think it would be disingenuous to give the impression that, you know, if you give these meds to your kid or have them take it for a long time, you know, they're going to sprout horns later in life. There's no indication one way or the other whether the drugs help or you know, increase the likelihood of a child becoming having a drug problem elsewhere, you know, a different type of drug problem versus, you know, protecting some kids against having a drug problem later because, you know, their impulsivity or their feelings of what's going on in their head, you know, perhaps they're well moderated, with these well-handled medications, you know, rather than, you know, the person being very impulsive and dealing with drugs in other ways. I think it really cancels each other out in many ways.
Well, and do you have anything on Sally's second question there, any relationship or not necessarily relationship, but the difference from a layperson's perspective between amphetamines or methylphenidates or phenidates like Ritalin and methamphetamines, which we're much more familiar with, I think, you know, as something that people make and quite a hazard and an addictive, just totally personality-changing drug?
Well, basically, methamphetamine has no particular well-handled medical use. I mean, technically, it can occasionally. But as you're discussing it, it's only abused. It's only taken in high doses. It is only taken in improper ways, to the point where it is taken only for the high. So I think we need to be careful in terms of, you know, even though they sound similar, mm-hmm. comparing the two too close to each other. Now, if you abuse amphetamine, if you snort it, for example, which some people do, they grind it up and snort it, they simply take too much, well, then you are doing to your brain something not dissimilar from what methamphetamine can do, okay? But I don't want to condemn the substance for human beings' mishandling of it. Methamphetamine, by definition, as you describe it, is being abused, and you're flooding your brain with this stuff. Well-handled amphetamine, yes, it can be addictive, even when handled appropriately, but it ain't nowhere near what methamphetamine is.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Alan Schwartz. He's the author of ADHD Nation. We've been talking this hour about the abuse of ADHD in a lot of ways. First, the abuse of the diagnosis and just kind of some cold numbers here that you would expect 5% of American children to have this disorder. Meanwhile, 15% are being diagnosed. We've moved on to talk about how some of the medications are both used, what their effects are, and how they are abused. Our last caller, Sally, had a question on that point. And Alan, you spend quite a bit of time in your book, ADHD Nation, talking about this young man, Jameson, who essentially fakes the disorder because he recognizes that these drugs, perhaps he's also gotten the marketing of the pharmaceutical companies, that these drugs help you with your schoolwork. In some ways, it seems very, like, almost pure of heart that he wants the drugs in order to be a better student. But then it takes him, you know, to a dark place. He's snorting them. He ends up addicted. And one thing that really struck me was that the doctors he sees keep prescribing him ADHD medications even when his drug abuse becomes known. Is that something you found to be common?
Well, it is certainly not uncommon, okay? And I don't think it derives, I understand your point, but it doesn't just derive at all from marketing of pharmaceutical companies. It derives from the marketing of kids in high schools who claim and have experienced a positive effect, and certainly in colleges. I mean, a lot of your listeners, I'm sure, took Dexedrin in college in order to stay up all night and study and
focus.
Well,
I mean, I went to college. I went to college in the 90s, actually, and Adderall and Ritalin were like currency. I mean, these little pills were floating around everywhere. Yeah, I mean, certainly our listeners and myself, you know, that part doesn't surprise me that college kids would abuse something that helps you stay up all night. But you're kind of quick to let – who is on the hook for this situation, I guess, to cut to the chase here, if it's not the marketing of pharmaceutical companies or it's not the doctor that continued to prescribe Ritalin to someone with a substance abuse problem? I mean,
that's what it is, okay, is in at least in my analysis. It is certainly indisputable. Pharma does not write prescriptions.
Uh-huh.
Okay? Nudgy parents don't write prescriptions. Teachers and school psychologists don't write prescriptions. The people who are the gateway to the meds, and for that matter, really to the diagnosis, are the medical professionals, oftentimes child psychiatrists or psychiatrists, increasingly pediatricians. Sometimes they're nurse practitioners, whoever it may be, depending on the laws of the state. Those are the folks who tell the parents, yes, your kid has this disorder. And, oh, by the way, here's a prescription. They are the ones who have signed a covenant with their state to handle this responsibility. properly. And too often, not always by any means, but too often they're doing a crummy job of determining which kid has it and which kid doesn't. And as you described in this kid, Jameson, and with a lot of other college and high school students across the country and increasingly working adults, who is merely faking the symptoms or claiming to have symptoms that they really don't have, but they just want these meds that can help them focus and study or perform at work. The doctors in general are doing a terrible job of just, you know, figuring out who does and who does not have it. I'm not saying it's easy, but it's a heck of a lot easier than they're making it look. And you can pretty well determine who's faking and who's not. And it is hard to determine who's faking and who's not, but you need to at least try. And it creates some impediments. And some colleges, by the way, are starting to do that. They are saying that we're not going to prescribe, you know, out of student health for a kid with ADHD unless we check with their parents that, you know, they really do have had a history of this disorder. Sometimes they require for the kid to, you know, submit to drug testing for two reasons. One, they might be taking too much, and two, they might be taking too little. And if they're taking too little, it's very possible that they're selling them or giving them to friends, which, by the way, is a federal crime.
And it's a Schedule 3 substance now?
Two.
So more there,
it's rated in, you know, Schedule 1 is drugs that do not have any medical use, like heroin. But Schedule 2 is for the most dangerously addictive drugs in medicine. And included in there are, of course, the opioids, oxycodone and whatnot, and stimulants, which are Adderall and Concerta and their, you know, similar products.
Let's get a call in here. We have time, a few more minutes left with Alan Schwartz, investigative reporter, author of ADHD Nation, 800-838-3760 to join the conversation, or you can drop us an email at jx@jeffnet.org. I want to go to Paul in Grants Pass. Paul, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. You're on the air.
Hi. Fascinating work that you've done. I had a little guy come into my life in the course of a relationship. He came in at 4. The relationship ended when he was about 6. When he came into the relationship, he had been diagnosed ADHD, and I was getting panicked calls from his mother that he was at a Montessori school attacking a child, drawing blood on both sides of his throat. By the end of the relationship, the child had been taken off of Ritalin, taken off of Adderall, and had moved from being very dangerous to being a member of his community's talented and gifted community. I'm absolutely convinced that this is, in fact, largely a diagnosis of convenience for parents who will not put the effort into creating the structure and the structure and the attention into these children where it's needed. And these kids generally tend to be very bright. As an adult and a professional, I did run into one person who truly had ADHD, and it was maddening working with him in my environment, but we got through it because of patience and maybe part of that experience. But I really do think, it's a comment, that this is a drug of choice for parents who really don't understand how to handle their kids. And
well, if may I respond? Do we have time for
a response? Yeah, please get in there, Alan.
I mean, I you can hear the sincerity in this caller's voice, and it's absolutely legitimate and based on his own experience. And, you know, he is not the only person to have experienced what he's recounting. I think, though, we need to realize that our individual experiences in terms of, well, you know, I knew this kid who, and therefore I'm going to create my, you know, impression of the whole field or the whole country, I would hate for listeners to feel as if ADHD drugs, you know, will cause a kid to attack another kid drawing blood. I understand it happened in this case, and that's incredibly important. I would not say that that is a common reaction by any means. In fact, if it were, we wouldn't be seeing so much use of this stuff. And then, to the extent that he has said that I feel as if it's a diagnosis of convenience, I agree with that. I'd be careful of going so far as to say for parents who don't want to discipline their kids. I think that parenting has become so much more difficult these days. Our standards have changed. The realities of single-parent homes, of two-parent working homes, of no recess and gym in schools, of higher class sizes. I think an awful lot has changed to challenge parents, I don't want to say willingness, but almost ability to perform the tasks that used to be routine. And I don't want to condemn, I personally don't want, and I'm not saying he was, but condemn parents for a lack of effort, because I think that impedes their ability to accept what it is we're talking about. They're going to get very defensive. And I think we need to keep an open mind to the challenges that everybody's facing, the children and the parents.
Well, Alan, I wish we had you for another hour, but at least we have your book, ADHD Nation. Quite a few listener comments here we didn't get to. They are so appreciated, and we'd love to continue this discussion on Facebook. Alan, this book's amazing. I review a lot for this program, and I pretty much devoured this one. Thank you so much for your important work and for being our guest today.
Well, thanks very much. And if people want to continue the conversation on our page, it's just ADHD Nation Book on Facebook, ADHD Nation Book.